Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery fiction in six double issues a year. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Our podcast features readings of short stories from the back issues of our magazine to give you a sense of what the magazine is about. And for this episode, Jocelyn Chase takes us back to a terrifying time in Victorian London with her story, The Wolf and Lamb, from our May-June 2020 issue. Jocelyn Chase is the author of Falling for the Lost Dutchman, set in Arizona, as well as 10 other mysteries and thrillers.
London, September 1888. Janet stirred as fingers of watery sunlight poked through the grimed glass of the bedroom window to tease at her eyelids. Consciousness arrived, and with it, a sense of dread. She sat up, clutching the blanket to her chest, and listened to the flurried footsteps and raised voices. A yearning enveloped her, so sharp and strong that it knocked the breath from her lungs, and she wrestled it down. It was no use wishing none of this had happened, that her father had not died, that she'd not been transported to the filthiest part of London, that a madman wasn't killing women in the streets. She rose, shivering in the morning air, and splashed her face with chill water, ignoring the greasy sliver of soap that smelled of rancid fat. She slipped into her green-sprigged morning frock, grateful that she could still dress as befitted a parson's daughter. For a while, anyway. When these clothes were worn to rags, she was afraid there would be no money to replace them. The advertisements she'd answered to serve as a lady's maid or governess had so far come to nothing, and it seemed she must work as a barmaid at her uncle's Whitechapel Inn far longer than she had hoped. She tugged a brush through her dark hair, remembering how her father had laughed over her unruly curls. "You are a fine, obedient daughter. It's no fault of yours that your head hosts a nest of rebellious curls. That was your mother's doing, though she was a good Christian woman. God rest her soul." Janet pushed the memory from her mind and swallowed the lump of self-pity. Life had dealt her a new hand, and she must play it to the best of her ability. Her father had not raised a milquetoast daughter. As she bent to lace her boots, a pounding came at the door, and her Uncle Smithers' voice bellowed through the thin walls. "The bar's half full already, though it be morning still, so get a move on. There's a crowd of constables and committee men needing a stiff belt after the night's events." Janet ran to catch him as he started down the stairs. "What's happened now? Another woman dead?" "Aye, and worse, two this time. A double event, they're calling it." Janet followed his broad back down to the bar room of the Wolf and Lamb. Her stomach shimmied and swam inside her, and it was just as well there was no time for breakfast, for she couldn't have swallowed even the crust of bread that had become her usual morning's fare. In the bar, a beer haze was already rising, and the fresh-strewn sawdust was swirled through with footprints. Half the room's tables were occupied, constables to the left, committeemen to the right, with a gaggle of working girls huddled between, their faces haggard, eyes wide with trepidation. "I thinks you boys should pay for our drinks," said one of the women, raising her mug into the air and thrusting out her chin. "A girl can't do business in the street these days, and you lot have been bloody useless." "Here, Wendy, that's not fair," protested a burly, ginger-haired constable. "We've tripled our patrols. We're doing all we can. The Ripper is an audacious blighter." "He's got guts, I'll give him that," piped up a man from the Vigilance Committee. Groans and growls of protest buffeted him into silence. "Your joke is in poor taste, Bill, but your point is well made." A grizzled veteran of the constable force spoke into the strained hush. "This killer is bold, determined to have his fun and take his prize. He was interrupted before he could properly carve into poor Long Liz. and less than an hour later, he takes down Kate so as he can finish the job. Lewis here is the one who interrupted him and saved Lizzie's skin, said a committee member, motioning to the steward from the workers' club. I saved her skin, but not her neck. He heard me coming and slashed her ear to ear so she couldn't scream out. How'd it happen, Lou? I drove my cart and pony into Dutfield's yard, and the old bobtail shies up with a whinny. He doesn't want to go in. The gaslight was out, and I had to light a match to see my way round. Rather wish I hadn't done. The blood was still flowing from the gash in her neck, and I could feel him there in the dark, watching me. Did you see him? Nay, and I didn't want to. If I'd have lifted the flame his way, I'd have seen the devil staring back at me. Fair raise the hair on the back of my neck, and make no mistake. I know what it feels like to stand in the presence of evil. Murder was no newcomer to the streets of Whitechapel. In the few months since Janet's arrival, she'd grown almost used to hearing the atrocities that were daily reported in the poverty-stricken East End of London. She was only glad that her gentle father had not lived to see her in such circumstances. Yet, if he was still living, she wouldn't be here at all, but back in their Yorkshire village, where her father served as parson and she as his assistant. The illness which had taken him had been swift, and she was thankful for the mercy in that, but she was unprepared for the equal swiftness with which her father's replacement had turned her out, and she'd been forced to seek out her only living relative, her mother's brother, Uncle Smither. He'd taken her in gladly enough, seeing her as an able-bodied serving girl, fit to shift trays of beer and spirits and clean the rooms for let on the upper floor, as she was doing now. Though to give him his due, he'd been kind to her, and as generous as his circumstances allowed. There was little soap or time for laundry. Unless the sheets were noticeably filthy, she'd been told to shake them out and make up the beds. The folk who stayed in these rooms were a slovenly lot, and the floors were scattered with debris and scummed with all manner of muck, spilled beer, spattered tobacco spittle, and worse. It was an unlovely job, and Janet deplored doing it, but she'd 1,000 times rather be a scrubbing and serving girl working on her feet than a strumpet working on her back, as so many of the women in Whitechapel seemed to be. The frankness with which these women hawked their wares continued to shock and distress the parson's daughter. No older than her, some of them, and yet their lives and experience were so vastly dissimilar that Janet classed them as different creatures, distinct from her own kind. She watched them with revulsion, appalled at their dress and behavior, unutterably mortified to see them leaving arm in arm with a paying customer. Many a night, after her prayers were said, she squirmed in bed, trying to shut her ears to the noises on the other side of the thin walls, her face hot with shame for the degeneracy that surrounded her. She adopted the habit of drifting to sleep by remembering her father's sermons, strengthening her embrace of the principles he'd taught, renewing her determination to remain untainted. That last day of September 1888, the day Jack the Ripper killed 2 prostitutes less than a mile from her home, Janet hoisted drinks and wiped tables for many hours. At the end of the day, she lay exhausted in bed, a pillow pressed over her head to blunt the sounds of the night, and thought about her father's last sermon. The text had been based on Proverbs chapter 31, verse 10. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. Another night in the bar room, and business was booming. Hearty talk and shouts of laughter floated above the yeasty atmosphere, and a hurdy-gurdy sounded from the draughty corner near the door, cranked by a shabbily dressed widow with a cup set out for coins. The woman's smile was faint and sad, her eyes distant and almost gone. Janet felt a kinship with her. They were both bereft and struggling to maintain some sense of gentility amidst the squalor of their situation. After the Ripper's double event, the night streets of Whitechapel had been near deserted. Women were careful to get indoors before sundown, and men avoided walking in the streets after dark, as that made them a target for police questioning. Custom at the pubs and in the streets was slow, and her uncle's face was grim as he counted out the takings at day's end. 3 weeks had passed, and then four, without another murder, and the year tipped into November. The story was kept alive in the press by delivery of sensational letters allegedly penned by Jack the Ripper himself. One of the epistles came with a small box containing a section of kidney believed to be that of Catherine Eddowes, the killer's fourth victim. It suddenly became the fashion for the West End crowd to tour the streets and frequent the pubs of Whitechapel, slaking their curiosity along with their thirst. They traveled in groups, boisterous and determinedly gay, as if their levity could protect them like a shield. The pub and street trade picked up again, and as Janet served drinks and mopped up spills, she gathered bits and pieces of gossip, speculations from police and press over the characteristics and behavior of the Ripper. Some said he must be one of the constables patrolling the streets, or how else could he keep getting away with it whilst they were so thick on the ground? That idea was hotly contested by the lawmen in the room and roundly denounced by the majority. Some authorities in the press said he had a medical background, while others denied it, saying even a butcher's boy displayed more finesse. There were rumors that he was left-handed, fair-haired, a West End toff, that he wore a peaked cap and owned a red scarf. A brazen few even suggested the Ripper might be a woman. In the midst of all these suppositions, Janet realized for the first time that the killer may have been in the Wolf and Lamb. She may have served him, wiped the glass his lips had touched. A wave of revulsion shuddered over her, tinged with terror. He might even have taken one of the rooms upstairs and slept close to her, with only a thin wall separating them. The thought was unnerving, and Janet reminded herself that he only targeted prostitutes, that her kind was safe from his killing knife. She kept a closer eye on the clientele, noting that the number of fashionable gentlemen who frequented the establishment was increasing. The working girls fussed and flirted. Deals were arranged and presumably consummated somewhere out of sight. Janet watched their seduction with a faint sense of horror. Her uncle appeared at her table. "What's wrong, my dear? You look as if you've seen the Ripper." She pulled her gaze away. "No, uncle." He regarded her, his face twisted with exasperation, yet softened by something like concern. "You're still bothered by the sluts, I'm guessing." Her face burned. To discuss such a subject seemed the height of impropriety, yet so much of her life was now, by all former standards, improper. She took courage and forced herself to look her uncle in the eye. "I find their behavior disgusting, don't you?" He turned to watch the women in question, with their bunched breasts and painted lips, their braying laughter and coquettish performance. When he turned back, a dark and pensive grief shone in his eyes. "I don't suppose a one of them took up the profession out of choice. They're playing a game called survival, Janet." She flushed. "There are other ways. What would you have done if you didn't have me to come to?" Janet pressed her lips together, refusing to go down that road. "I'd have found something." He regarded her, his face kind. "Yes, perhaps you would have." "They're like ravening wolves," she burst out. "Look at them." Her uncle didn't turn his head, holding her gaze instead. "Aye, they're hungry, just like everyone else on the East End. You see them as wolves, but if you look more closely, you'll see they're merely lambs in wolves' clothing. It's the proper gentlemen who come in here sporting their fine lambs' apparel that are the true wolves." Janet's eyes widened in astonishment, and she opened her mouth to protest, then shut it with a snap. She considered her uncle's perspective. Why else would the men come from across town, if not to hunt? I'm not a completely godless man, Janet. I don't set foot in church but once a year or so. But I was raised up the same as your mother, and I remember a few of my Sunday school lessons. I try not to judge, but to have charity. At any rate, it's a mutually advantageous relationship when the lambs and the wolves all get along. Note the name bar hanging outside the door. Janet hadn't given a thought to the name of her uncle's establishment until that moment. You named your inn the Wolf and Lamb, she said, comprehension dawning. And now you know why. He sent her off with a tray of drinks. Janet felt a bit dazed, so radical was her uncle's philosophy to anything she'd considered before. The scriptures were full of admonitions against fornication and whoredoms, yet, as her uncle had pointed out, they abounded also with mandates for charity and mercy. Her head spun, trying to reconcile what seemed like two clashing ideas. She set mugs of beer and glasses of gin on the crowded tables and delivered a whiskey to a lone gentleman at a back booth. He wasn't known among the regulars, but Janet had seen him here before and remembered that he occasionally took a room for the night. As she thought about it, a little shock went through her. She was almost certain the last time he'd come was the night of the double event. The first woman to die that night had been Elizabeth Stride, known as Long Liz, and she'd drunk a glass of beer in the Wolf and Lamb just hours before her death. It was likely a coincidence, but Janet found her gaze darting back to the stranger as he nursed his drink, his attention on the action at the other tables. He lifted the glass with his left hand, and that might be significant, but the experts had argued over the left-handed conclusion, and no one could say for sure. The man was fair-haired, and a peaked cap rested on the table next to the glass of whiskey. Janet shook herself. Surely she was attaching too much meaning to these small, speculative details. His interest seemed to be in Dark Mary, an Irish doxy a decade or two younger than the Ripper's preferred victim. So Janet put her fears down to imagination and wiped the scarred surface of the bar, pocketing a meager tip left by one of the regulars. Dark Mary was drinking too much, and Janet knew that would lead to a round of maudlin Irish crooning, followed by a rash of bad temper. True to form, the woman started in with Rosemary Fair, before moving on to Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms. Three lines into Danny Boy, she lashed out with a fist and fetched young Jeremy a bloody nose. Ow, Mary, what was that for? You was looking down my dress. Bloody hell, woman, last week you clouted me for not looking down your dress. What do you want from me? Leave me alone. I want you all to just leave me alone. The drunk girl stumbled from her chair, weaving a zigzagged line for the door. She stopped to adjust her bonnet and pull a shawl around her shoulders before stepping out into the night. Jeremy, you should go after her, said one of the other girls. You heard her. She wants to be left alone. With a left hook like that, no one will mess with our Mary, he said, pressing a bloody handkerchief to his nose. She lost the key to her room. How will she get in? Oh, she took care of that by breaking the window pane so she can reach in and turn the knob. There was a titter of laughter. That's Dark Mary for you. Janet turned away to put a row of glasses on the shelf behind. A current of air stirred the hairs at the back of her neck, and she was startled to see the stranger pass out the door, the peaked cap pulled low over his brow. A rush of fear washed over her, a primal tug at the core of her instinct. He was going after Dark Mary. She knew it. She moved her gaze about the room, looking for her uncle, but he was nowhere in sight, having stepped out on some errand. Without stopping to think, she rushed out the door after the strange man, ready to raise a hue and cry if she should find him accosting the drunk prostitute. Pockets of fog wafted in the night air, obscuring great swaths of the street scene. Janet saw no one about as she ran a ways down Duke Street, staying to the center of the lane to avoid the open mouths of dark alleys. She peered into the night, calling out Mary's name. For answer, she heard only the barking of a distant dog. Her foot caught on an uneven cobble, and she fell to the frost-rimed stones, the breath knocked from her body. As she struggled to fill her lungs, her gaze was drawn by a movement in the shadows. She looked on in horror as a dark figure materialized in the fog. The face was in shadow, but the silhouette included the shape of a peaked hat atop the head. Unable to draw breath to scream, Janet worked to get her feet under her. The fog parted, and in that moment, she saw a glint of steel. A clatter of hoofbeats sounded from the top of the road, and Janet felt their vibrations beneath her palms. The carriage moved at a fast clip, and if she didn't move soon, she'd be trampled. She rolled to the right, away from the dark figure, and the carriage came into view, cutting between them. At last, she was able to pull breath into her lungs, and she used it not to scream, but to propel her legs in a desperate run for safety. At the threshold of the Wolf and Lamb, she paused to look back, her heart racing with fear and the exhilaration of escape. The street was once again empty. By morning, all of London knew about the most vicious murder yet. Dark Mary was dead. Not killed in the street as the other victims, but in her own room with the broken window pane. And on this instance, the Ripper had taken his time, slicing and mutilating until the corpse was well nigh unrecognizable. Janet told her uncle about her suspicions and what had happened in the street. He went to the police, and Janet's suspect was identified and taken in for questioning, like dozens of other men had been, on the tales and suspicions of witnesses. Janet was dismayed to hear the man was released within a day. He had connections among the influential, and the police had no more reason to hold him than they had for any other citizen in good standing. Both the Metropolitan Police and Scotland Yard were stymied, and Janet was at least as baffled by her own behavior. She had run out into the night, unprotected and unarmed, for the sake of a harlot. The messy reality of life was not as clear-cut as it had seemed from the comfort and security of the parsonage. She felt real grief over the death of Dark Mary, and a sense of failure at being unable to stop it. Almost dizzied by the harrowing events and her shifting perceptions, she began to understand that she'd rushed out that night in an instinctive defense of a fellow human being against an unspeakable evil. By late morning, the Wolf and Lamb usually held a sprinkling of working girls in for their morning tea and milk. Janet included a cup for herself and joined a table with three other women. "Bless us all, the Queen's dropped in for tea." The girl named Clara cocked her pinky finger and took a delicate sip with lips still bearing traces of last night's lipstick. Janet felt her face flush as Bess and Margaret, eyebrows raised and chins thrust forward, regarded her over the scratched surface of the table. "My name's Janet. Would you mind if I sat with you?" "Take care, Janet," Bess said, leaning so far forward that Janet could see the pores in her unwashed skin. "Not too close, or you might catch our stain." An ember of irritation flared within her, then winked out like the ash of a dying fire. These girls had to test the waters and throw up defenses in order to survive. "I wanted to say I'm sorry about what happened to Mary." A moment of silence, tinged by regret and horror, passed between them. The three women clanked their tea mugs together, and after a slight pause, Janet joined hers to theirs. They drank without speaking. Janet finished her cup and wrapped her hands around its residual warmth. "I also wanted to say that I hope you'll take extra care on the streets and do all you can to watch out for each other." Clara gave a cackle and tossed back a wave of midnight-colored hair. "It almost sounds as if she cares what happens to the likes of us." There was a round of hostile laughter, and Janet, solemn-faced, waited for it to fade before rising. Tea's my treat this morning. I really do hope you'll be careful. Another lull descended over the East End, and business at the Wolf and Lamb was slow. The height of action came from a wrangle between Janet's uncle and Thomas Winger, one of the regulars. The day was chill, and a gray pall hung in the air that couldn't be dispelled by a fire in the hearth or a drink in the belly. Uncle Smither and Thomas sat at the bar, nursing their beers and sharing a dish of sausages, while Janet wiped glasses and neatened the counter. "It seems the Ripper is cleaning up the streets of London, one whore at a time," said Thomas. "That's a crass way of looking at it, Thomas. That's not how you really feel, is it? Do you read the Bible, Smithers?" "I've been known to skim a passage or two." "Let me quote you one. Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 6. Wherefore a lion out of the forest shall slay them, and a wolf of the evening shall spoil them. A leopard shall watch over their cities. Every one that goeth out thence shall be torn in pieces, because their transgressions are many, and their backslidings are increased." If that doesn't describe our situation, I don't know what does. I recall a different chapter and verse. The one about a God who loved the world so much that he sent his Son, that whoso believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. If it's the New Testament you prefer, there's one in Acts about abstaining from pollutions, fornications, things strangled, and blood. And how would you have responded to Jesus when he invited the one who was without sin to cast the first stone? Enough with the clash of the Bibles. Those sluts bring the indignation of God down upon all of us, and you know it. Get out of my bar, Thomas. Eh? What are you saying, Smithers? I said, get out of my bar. Her uncle's voice was low and measured, but Janet sensed the banked fire beneath. Come on, Thomas, she said, leading him to the door. Here's your coat and hat. Take care on the way home. The stones have gone icy. She came back to the bar and laid a hand on her uncle's shoulder. I grew up on scripture, she said, but I'm finding I still have so much to learn. We none of us get out of this world alive, Janet, but the good Lord gives us to the very end to figure it out. The worst thing about a murderer is he takes away that chance for his victim. Janet studied her uncle's reflection in the bit of mirror above the bar. Do you think anyone ever goes past the point of no return? She asked. I don't know, Janet. He paused, rubbing a hand against his temple. It's hard to believe the Ripper could ever be human again. Janet tossed in her narrow bed, shivering a little, though her uncle had given her the best duvet in the house. The moon, nearly full, peeped in through the frosted panes of her tiny window, painting the floor with stripes of silver, intensifying the shadows of the far corner. Her mind writhed under a myriad of conflicting thoughts and memories, an attack upon the foundational blocks of her upbringing, and yet that foundation was firm. She had no doubt of the core principles. It was a question of application. A command as basic as thou shalt not kill was offset by the command for the children of Israel to destroy every living thing within the fallen walls of Jericho, sparing only the harlot Rahab and her family. God bless David with the power to slay Goliath. And what of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite? In the book of Judges, she was called blessed above women, because she drove a nail through Sisera's head while he slept, killing the dreaded enemy. These heroes had not killed out of revenge, but to preserve their people. Each had been in a unique position and given the opportunity to strike against evil and oppression, and each had lived ever after with the consequences of their actions. Had they slept easy, or did they wrestle as she did now? The moon lowered in the sky. As it dropped beneath the windowsill, Janet's eyelids ceased their restless flutter, and exhaustion sent her finally to sleep. In the morning, she rose from the bed and knelt beside it, drawing a small trunk from beneath. These were her father's belongings, the last she had of him. His Bible, with its beautiful hand-tooled leather cover, was on top. She lifted it, running her finger over the textured lettering before putting it aside. Next was her mother's diary, every word committed to memory. That and a few photographs were all she'd ever known of her mother, apart from what her father had told her. At the bottom of the box, Janet found the small, capped vial. She washed and dressed, and just before going down to the bar, she slipped the vial into her apron pocket. The days grew colder as November neared its end, and London held its breath. If Jack followed a pattern, it seemed to dictate an attack on the last day of the month. As the sun set on the 30th, a thick fog rolled in, like an accomplice to the Ripper. The constables put every man available on patrol, and the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee was out in force, while the working girls huddled in bars and taverns, moving outside only in groups. The killer would be hard put to find a victim or a place to do his deed, but few doubted that he'd be brazen and resourceful enough to find a way. The atmosphere in the Wolf and Lamb was strained and too quiet. Without the shabby widow and her hurdy-gurdy, or Dark Mary singing her folk tunes, the air was somber and empty. Men spoke in subdued voices, and women flirted without conviction or enthusiasm. Janet stared into the hearth fire, mesmerized by the dancing flames and the soothing crackle they emitted. She watched the fire gutter and then strengthen as the front door opened and closed on the arrival of a new patron. Tugging her gaze away from the flame, she turned to take the newcomer's order and bit back a gasp. It was him. He sat at the same table as before, but his attention this time was not on the assortment of available women. He asked for a whiskey, and Janet felt his eyes bore into her back as she walked to the bar. She bit her lip, trying to control the shaking in her hands as she poured out the spirits. From beneath her lashes, she saw he was watching her carefully. Dare she do it? With a deep breath, she steadied herself and took the vial from her apron pocket. Laudanum, left over from her father's illness. Her motions were hidden by the rise of the bar, yet she felt so exposed as she tapped measured drops into the glass of whiskey. Too much at once would leave a bitter and detectable taste. She hoped the stranger would order more than one drink so she could string out the dosage. The tray trembled, and she had to hold it with two hands as she walked slowly back to the table and placed the drink before him. He gave a sardonic smile, raised the glass, and tipped it to her before taking a sip. Janet turned away, but he caught her hand, pulling her back. "The coppers brought me in for questioning, and I'm thinking you had something to do with that." Janet wrenched her fingers out of his grasp. She thought of the laudanum and raised her chin. "I might have done. And all because I tried to help you up after you took a spill? What kind of thanks is that? Sit with me, Janet, and ask my forgiveness." Janet dropped her gaze, hugging the tray against her chest. "I'm sorry, sir. I was mistaken." He caught hold of her skirt and pulled her towards him. "Sit. Let's have a drink together. I have friends in high places who will tell you what a nice fellow I am." Janet yanked the fabric from his fingers, and he laughed. Aware that he was enjoying her unease, she straightened her shoulders and drew a breath, stepping sharply out of his reach. "I'll bring you another whiskey." As he drank, he continued to follow her with his eyes. When she served him his third drink of the night, now laced with enough laudanum to put him under, she could see that he was waning. His movements were slow, his speech beginning to slur. Ah, Janet, he managed. I'm finished with the appetizers. You'll make me a fine main course. He tried lifting his drink in a toast, but his arm was too heavy. It was time to enlist help, but she could not afford to call on the police again. He had influence, and if they turned him loose, as they had the last time, she'd lost a prime opportunity to stop his butchery. Maybe her only opportunity. She found her uncle in the kitchen, washing dishes. Uncle Smither, one of the customers, is drowsy drunk. He asked for a room earlier. Perhaps we should take him up? Together, they succeeded in getting him up the stairs, though he protested and struggled against them. By the time they dumped him in bed, he was snoring. Janet and her uncle returned to the barroom. Custom grew sparser than ever into the wee hours of the morning, and Uncle Smither sent Janet to bed. Boards creaked beneath her feet as she mounted the stairs, breathing heavy not from exertion, but from the turmoil in her breast. She listened at the stranger's door, and hearing no sound from the room, let herself in and stood trembling at the threshold. The mounded shape under the blanket did not stir beneath the square of moonlight cast through the window. With cautious steps, Janet approached the bed, alert for a break in the even breathing patterns, watching the sleeping face for fear the eyes might pop open and he spring upon her. His coat hung from a hook on the wall where her uncle had placed it, and she took it down to go through the pockets. She drew out a long knife, thin and sharp, as the newspapers had described the weapon used by the Ripper. Though it looked as if an effort had been made to clean it, the surface was dulled by stains that would not wash out, and the seams between blade and handle were lined with a crusty brown substance. Janet shuddered, and her stomach rebelled. Biting her lip, she took hold of herself. She had started down this road, and she would finish it. Another shape was manifest in the coat pocket, something flat and metallic. She removed a tin of the sort that might hold gentlemen's snuff. This one did not. An odor both sweet and fetid assailed her as she opened the box. A slice of some internal organ rested there, drying in its own slime, a keepsake, but far more putrid and sinister than a loved one's lock of hair. Janet closed the tin and replaced it, along with the knife, all doubt gone, determination renewed. She hoped the dose she'd given him was sufficient for her needs as she eased the pillow from beneath his head and pressed it against his face, interrupting the soft snoring. His hand flew up, clenching her forearm, and she struggled, kneeling astride him to press all her weight against the pillow. It seemed an age as he flailed beneath her, but at last his grip grew feeble, loosening by degrees until his hand fell away to lay atop the blanket, a gnarled claw in the moonlight. She felt no overwhelming sense of emotion, no elation, and no grief. For her, this was not an act of vengeance, for that belonged to the Lord alone. This was an opposition to evil, like David's stone or the nail of Jael, an act in defense of humanity. She waited a long moment in the moonlight before removing the pillow and looking down into the face of the Ripper. No horns or forked tongue marked him out, yet malice seemed carved into his features, something he'd invited in and allowed to transform him. He made himself a servant of the devil, and she had vanquished him. A final scripture came to her mind, and she whispered it into the night air. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like the bullock. She placed the pillow back under the dead man's head and left the room as she had come. Closing the door, she leaned against it until the quickened beat of her heart returned to normal. She missed her father with a physical ache and the life they'd led together. That girl would never have snuffed out a man's life. she wouldn't have needed to. But the field had changed. Janet remembered her uncle's words. They're playing a game called survival. So was she, and tonight she'd scored a major strike against evil. She crossed to her own room and climbed into bed. There, under the gilded moonlight, she lay until her eyelids dropped shut, and she slept.
That was Jocelyn Chase reading her story, The Wolf and Lamb, from the back issues of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find essays on writing by our authors at our blog, traceevidence.net. That's trace-evidence.net. This podcast was produced with the help of our managing editor, Jackie Sherbo, and editorial assistant, Kevin Wheeler. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.